I'm going to read from the first chapter of this novel, The Seamstress of Hollywood Boulevard. It's based on the life of my grandmother. This opening part is as close as I can get to an imaginative rendering of what happened to my grandmother. This is my father's mom, and it's a story that I grew up with, and so it's been something I've been thinking about for a while. I should tell you that my father was tremendously excited that I was writing this book, even though I was giving away some fairly tawdry family secrets. He was really, really happy about it. And he died 2 days before the book was published. Aww. I know. That's how I feel too. And so he had read it. He'd read it in manuscript, and he was very, very happy with it. But I like to start readings with a little shout out to Dad in case he's listening, hoping that he likes what he hears. We are situated in Kansas in 1899. I couldn't cook, but I could sew. It would have been better the other way around. Luelle Morrissey had a face like a mud hen's backside, but everybody in Mercer County knew she could make a good meal, even at the end of winter, when nothing was left in the root cellar but tired apples. Folks talked about Luelle's knack for food, and at church socials, her pies were bid up past $3. A good cook is good value, said Ordell Reitzbaugh, one of three ranchers courting her. By the time I was 9 years old, I could sew a straight seam, and at 15, I could make a hem stitch that no one could see, but nobody assigns value to what he can't see. I didn't have the right mind for putting meals on the table. Staring into the crusty frying pan and waiting for onions to color, I got bored. Hot and itchy, I would stroll out to lean on the garden fence and look at the dim horizon as if it might have changed in the last 10 minutes. The flat dirt, gray-brown, folded into the flat sky, gray-white, and behind me the onions burned. At night, Pa poked his fork at my stew, lumps of flour floating next to the shingles of black onion. If we auctioned you, you wouldn't bring in as much as a mule, he said. More than chickens, though, I said. How many chickens? A dozen, easy. I am good value, I said. For somebody who already ate, he said. Meals would have gone better if he'd just let Mama or one of my sisters cook, but he had ideas about things, and Tuesdays were my cooking days. He thought I'd learn. My family and the hands, the years we had hands, learned to avoid dinner on Tuesdays. Me, I was skinny as a whip and could get through the daylight hours on an apple. No matter what Pa would admit, I had my value. I could weigh a spool of thread in my hand and tell if it was rotten at the center. I could stitch a buttonhole in brand new denim, and I could mend a tear so that it blended right into the cloth around it, invisible even in church when the eye needed something to rest on. There were other values. I was good with people, unlike my shy sisters. I was smart about Pa, too, and I could judge when he had drunk one glass of whiskey too many and was itching to hit something. My doughy sisters never learned to clear out of his path, but I could smell a beating was coming the same way that a person can smell rain. That's bad-looking leather, he'd say, looking at a patched harness. Cheap. Everything about it looks cheap. Then he'd raise his head and say, it's not one thing worth a tinker's dam on this place, or in this county, or in this state. The fury would sweep over him like storm clouds. Folks knew him as a joke teller, but he wasn't always amiable, and his jokes could turn rough in a hurry. Even Mama, so dim she never seemed to recognize anything, said Pa and I were cut from the same pie. Like him, I was restless all the time, ants under my skin, and a day spent plowing would leave me fretful with wanting something I couldn't put a name to. When I trudged out to the barn, my eyes cut over our paltry 160 acres of wheat the same way his did. Everyone around us was buying up acreage before land prices went up again. Soon, ours would be the smallest farm in the county. It didn't need to be so. Pa could have borrowed money to expand. But Pa looked out to the west, toward what he didn't own, what nobody owned. He didn't want more of what he already had. He was squinting at the fence line when I came up to him one afternoon. He'd put his hat aside somewhere in the back of his shirt, bunched up out of his trousers. The man was careless, shedding things wherever he went, shoes and papers and tobacco. Mama spent her life picking up his litter. Myself, I would have let it lie. Feller dies and goes to the seat of judgment, he said, eyes trained on the blurred horizon. Jesus said, you got yourself a bad record. You've cheated, stolen, lied. You're going to have to go to hell. Feller falls down at the feet of the Lord. He cries and begs for mercy. It's true that I didn't lead a good life, but I wasn't all evil. I cared for my mama and I gave to the poor. I gave money to your church. The Lord softens. All right, he says, I'll take mercy on you. You can start again, homesteading in Kansas. Feller stops crying, looks up at the face of the Lord. Is that spot in hell still open? Dare you to tell it to the preacher, I said. Not everybody wants to hear the truth, he said. Preacher says only the gospel is the truth. This is a different gospel, Pa said, for those who have ears. Dare you to tell it to the visiting preacher. He's coming to dinner. Mama sent me out to fetch you. You're not cooking, are you? It's Thursday, I said, my sister May's turn. Lucky for him. Mama wants you to wear your Sunday shirt. Bad is going to church, he said. If I have to wear my Sunday shirt in my own house, maybe I will tell my joke. He didn't get a chance, though. Reverend Farley had jokes of his own, the one about the lamb and the peacock, the one about the squirrel who went to Bible camp, the one about the three ministers who went to heaven. After a while, we stopped forcing ourselves to laugh, since our laughter made no difference to the reverend. While May's good pot roast hardened in front of him, he planted an elbow on either side of the plate and said, Man finds himself at the pearly gates. The Lord says, Son, it's your day of reckoning. You've lived a bad life. You smoked, you drank, you didn't do right in business. There's only one place for you to go. We know this one, Pa said. Reverend Farley didn't even pause. The man says, Remember when I saved that widow? Remember when I ran into the burning house and snatched up the baby? Doesn't that count for something? The Lord nods. You're right. Those things count for something. You can go to Wichita. The man says, Remember that $100 I stole? Into the quiet around the table, Pa said, We tell it different. I imagine so. Everybody loves this one in Texas. Mama got up a smile and shook her head. You're regular theater. Do you come from Texas? I said. Girls in Mercer County didn't talk at table, and Pa's glance was sharp. I travel so much anymore, I'm not sure where I come from. I know where I'm going when the Lord tells me to hang up my spurs, though. You're not wearing spurs, Pa said. Where, Reverend? Said polite Mama. California, heaven on earth. I don't imagine that's part of your circuit, said Pa. I was ailing for a time, and I went to Los Angeles to recover my health. I don't mind telling you, I'd go back, even if it meant falling sick again. What ailed you? Pa said. Tell us about California, I said at the same time. I could see that my chatter was nettling Pa, but he wouldn't lay a hand on any of us before company. Reverend Farley put on a sharp smile that didn't look right on a preacher. If California is not the promised land, it's the closest we'll see in this life. To walk in an orange grove is to be in Eden. The air smells sweet and tangy at the same time, and the leaves shine and the oranges all but push themselves into your hands. Have you ever eaten an orange? Pa said, We see a few luxuries. We're not poor. Your mouth tingles, but the fruit is sweet and so quenching you imagine you'll never be thirsty again. And the flowers are tiny, but they give out a powerful scent. And then you get to the end of the grove, and the next thing you see is ocean crashing onto sand. Salty soil kills most plants, Pa said. Guess your orange trees are different. Reverend Farley made a brushing motion. Maybe not exactly at the end of the grove, but close. What does it look like? I said. The Reverend stopped talking, which amazed us all. He looked around the kitchen, eyes skidding over the freshly black cook stove and the magazine pictures Mama had put up on the walls, over the hard dirt floor and the pie safe with the weeping willow punched into its tin door. He picked up a white enamel pot lid with a blue rim and said, Hold this close to your eyes. When I held it up, he said, Closer, until the edge of the pot of the lid was practically in my eye. What do you see? He said. The blue is wobbly, and then there's white over it. That's all. That's close, he said, except it's beautiful. I like the land myself, Mama said. I like seeing where I stand. Would you care for some pie? I kept staring at the lid. What I saw, the blur of blue into white, wasn't beautiful, but I could imagine it turning beautiful. I probably looked like a pure fool, staring at a pot lid as if it were a magazine picture. But the minister had given me something that I didn't understand. There was nothing of Kansas in that blue line. After May's dried apple pie, Reverend Farley put down his fork and announced, Now that was cause for Thanksgiving, the first churchy thing he'd said since giving the blessing. I put on a pleasant expression, planning to think about oceans while he talked about salvation. Pa looked sour. But Reverend Farley kept unsettling us. He reached into his shirt pocket and pulled out a harmonica. The first song he played was Amazing Grace, which we none of us sang well. And after that, he started on a tune I'd never heard. Sweet and slow, it had a clean ache. And I studied the tablecloth so no one would be able to see my wet eyes. Mama joined in, her low voice true. Oh, Shenandoah,
I long to hear you. Look away, you rolling river. She sang only when she felt moved. Sometimes years would pass. But when she opened her mouth, we all hushed. Suddenly the air was rich, and so it became poor when she stopped. That's no church song, Pa said, when the last note was still hovering. It can be, Reverend Farley said. How? Pa said. It's about having to go away. It's not what you want to do. It's what you have to do. I said, why does somebody have to go away? Me? I heard a call, Reverend Farley said. What about somebody who's not a reverend? I said. Nell, Mama said. What does a call sound like? I said, heedless as a chick. It wasn't Mama who would hurt me. Reverend Farley said, two Episcopalian ministers arrive at the same church with the congregation there waiting. It's a big church. Folks are well-dressed. There are fine carriages outside. The first one says to the people in the church, I heard a call. I don't know what that other fellow's doing here. I heard a call too, said the second preacher. What did yours say? Lo, I will make you a leader of nations. What did yours say? No one ever lost money on hog futures. Preach on, cried the congregation. Pa snorted. Myself, I'd never seen an Episcopalian. I said, I don't think anybody gets called to Kansas for money. Nobody's got any. Reverend Farley said to Pa, she's the spit of you, isn't she? Her bad luck, Pa said. Reverend Farley stayed in town for a week, but we didn't go to hear him preach past the first day, when everyone went. I didn't want to see any more of the man. He'd left me feeling rumpled, and even if I wasn't fool enough to repeat the experiment with the pot lid, I couldn't forget the glimpse he had given me of a view that was light and rested on a color I'd never seen in nature. Pa could see my distraction. I was never able to hide anything from the man if he wanted to look, and ever since the dinner with Reverend Farley, he kept me close to hand. The Tuesday after the Reverend's visit, he took me out to the barn. Did you call me out here because you're wanting a piece of meat tonight that's cooked all the way through, I said. You're a stubborn thing. He handed me the flat tin of barn salve that we used on all the cows' cuts and wounds. The salve had been white once, but it had aged to a thick yellow and smelled like bad cooking fat laced with kerosene. The barn stank whenever we opened the tin. Pa said, you could make things easy, but you won't do it. What's easy? The smell of the greasy salve stuck to me. The cow twitched her flat rump and huffed irritably. Girls half your age can manage to make a loaf of bread that doesn't come up gummy in the middle. It's a knack. I haven't got it. I think we can all see that much. He reached across the cow's back to flick a bit of salve from my face. Girl, what do you want? If he'd looked mean or angry, I would have known what to say, but his face was stony. Mostly, I was aware of the rich, sweet smell of the cows, the tang of manure, and the acrid medicine that was smeared halfway up to my elbows now. I like to sew, I said. I went to town last week. Jack Platt asked after you. His daddy's spread is bigger than this one. My hand shook a little when I said, what did you tell him? I told him you were tolerable. You don't help a girl much, do you? I don't see as that's my job. The Platts had a house with a window, and it occurred to me that it would be a fine thing to look outside of a house during the daylight. Pa said, what should I have told him, Nell? That you spent half an evening looking at a pot lid as if it could tell you something? No, don't tell him that. Jack will come to see you if I don't stop him. That's what people do, I think. They come to see each other. I'm only going to ask you this once. Is Jack what you want? He let me take my time. Jack was a new thought. Marriage was a new thought, though it shouldn't have been. Just last month, the Reverend read out Nassine and Ernal's banns while Nassine sat like the Queen of Sheba in the front row, thinking on babies, Ernal's wood frame house, and a new wringer washer. She wasn't but a month older than me. Unbidden images tumbled through my head. Berlinda and Marlon Mallory ran off to Hutchinson to get married, and for months after they came back, Berlinda told about the hotel there and the wide streets. No one has called on May yet, I said unsteadily. There's no law. It wouldn't be easy, just her and Viola. May was already 17, but little Vi was only 9 and not handy. We'll manage. Listen up, Nell. If you don't want Jack, I'll tell him. Mrs. Jack Platt. Jack was shorter than me, with bandy legs and hair so curly we used to say bah to him in school. He'd stopped school at 12 rather than boarding in Hayes for high school, but I saw the Platts at church and in town. A person had to put his mind to it to disappear in Mercer County. Like everyone, I knew that Jack's mother was a tyrant, his father a quiet man who stayed out of his wife's way. Jack favored his mother, and I wondered whether that should worry me. His lamb-like curls were hers, and his strut, and his quick, cutting words when he was exercised. But he had once spent better than an hour flat on his belly under an outhouse, coaxing two kittens to come out to him. He must have washed them, because when he brought them home in a basket, they were as fluffy as kittens on a greeting card, and he talked his mother into keeping them. I hadn't seen any of this, but everybody knew the story. I would learn other stories, different ones, if I lived in the Platt place. He's nice enough, I said. I won't stop you, Pa said. I just want you to think. What's to think about? Once you decide, you've decided. You can't come up for air later and say, God, that was a mistake. So think, is this what you want out of your future? Future's a hard thing to see. I presume that Pa was thinking about me, squinting across the top of a pot lid. I could still see that wavery line full of possibility. You better can. Did you, when you courted Mama? He spread more salve, working the yellow ointment down into the little craters that oozed with their own clear juice. Your mother is a good woman. I couldn't ask for a better one. She knows how to stretch a nickel, and she doesn't hanker after what she can't have. He wasn't saying anything but the truth. Pa and I were the hankerers. She's never raised her voice to me, even when she ought should have, he said. When I called on her, folks said she was sweet as a honey cake. What I'm about to say is not a complaint, you hear me? I esteem your mother. I won't hold with anything else. Now that Pa had stopped touching her backside, Dixie was placid, munching the oats he put out for her. It's a fine thing to share your days with a person. That's what marriage is, sharing. You share a home and a place. You share children. But your mother and I don't see the world alike. When I look over the fields, I see fences that need fixing, the place where the seed washed out. She doesn't see those things. I know that, I said. I'm trying to tell you something. What do you know about Jack? Same as you. Their place will support another mouth and his mother's a pistol. Not much. Where else am I going to go? You're still a youngster. Wait for a feller who you know you like. Guess I'll be waiting for Reverend Farley to come back. Guess you won't either. Man who lives riding circuit isn't looking for a wife to support. And his jokes were no good. Then I guess I'd better let Jack Platt come to call, since I'm not interested in being a spinster lady. As if it had been waiting for just this moment, my mind produced a list of Mercer County bachelors. Sam Wynn, whose last wife had died in childbirth at age 20 and who held girls too tight at dances. Carth Noller, who lived in town and ran the post office along with a funeral home. The scattering of ranchers who came in for feed and looked over girls with the same eyes they used for livestock. In that company, Jack looked fine. There's no call to rush. You're still half a child. This was the first time Pa had indicated I was anything but all a child, and hearing him say so brought feeling up in me, something hard, screwed tight. Everyone in Mercer County knew his pride in me, his middle girl, no bigger than a minute, but still a fire pop. The cow ointment stung my eyes. I said, I'm not after staying on the smallest ranch in Kansas. I'd like to see something fresh for a change. He put on a grin I'd never seen before. It looked bashful, and it made the feeling in me tighten even more, like a jar lid twisted until it breaks. He said, it's not enough for you to see your old Pa? That's the first thing I want to stop seeing, I said, hating the words the second they flew from my mouth. They were not what I meant to say. There were no words for what I meant to say. Pa's face slammed shut. He pitched the open tin of cow ointment at me. Its top side stuck itself square against my nose and eyes, and for a panicky second, all I could breathe was old, sticky fat and kerosene. Next week, Pa was saying as I shook the tin off, tomorrow, I won't have your mother living with a child who doesn't know respect. Is there a rag? I said. He threw a feed sack at me so hard the tie strings whipped me on the ear. Mouth on you like an outhouse. No gratitude. I rubbed the burlap over my face, scraping the clots of ointment that we would need again back into the tin. I'm guessing Oris Platt doesn't throw cow medicine at anybody. I wouldn't bet against his wife's throwing arm, though. Looks like you'll be finding out. You can write us a letter and tell us all. Are you going to lock me out of the house tonight? I should. But you'll have a home here as long as you want it. And you don't want it. I stood wiping myself clean until Pa left the barn, the cow making contented grunts. There didn't seem anything wrong with Jack. I was 15 years old. Thank you.
going to start off by reading some poems from a book called Shut Up, You're Fine, Poems for Very, Very Bad Children. That subtitle, which actually seems to have, you know, make people think it's actually for children, was forced on me and the publisher by the big box bookstores. The title I wanted to call it was Troubling Poems for Troubled Children. The problem with that, they said, and they were right, is that it would end up in self-help section. And it's happened. It's an honor to read humor at the Thurber House. So thank you for that. This is a poem called Playing Dead. My dad actually did this. He would lie down on the bed and play that he was dead. And I've since run into other people whose dads would do this. And, you know, and if you think about it, there's no way that this can end well. Either he convinces you that he's dead, or you do something so extreme to him that he proves to you that he's alive. Playing dead. Our father liked to play a game. He played that he was dead. He took his thick black glasses off and stretched out on the bed. He wouldn't twitch and didn't snore or move in any way. He didn't even seem to breathe. We asked, "Are you okay?" We tickled fingers up and down his huge, pink, stinky feet. He didn't move. He lay as still as last year's parakeet. We pushed our fingers up his nose and wiggled them inside. Next, we peeled his eyelids back. "Are you okay?" we cried. I really thought he might be dead and not just playing possum, because his eyeballs didn't twitch when I slid my tongue across them. "He's dead," we sobbed, "but to be sure, I jabbed him in the jewels. He rose like Jesus from the dead, though I don't think Jesus drools. His left hand lashed both right and left. His left hand clutched his scrotum, and the words he yelled, I know damn well, I'm way too young to quote him." Now, that's a poem, thank you. That's a poem that the NEA has used in high school recitation exercises, and I'm sure that it's popular just because boys get to stand up and shout scrotum, you know, in front of when I was a kid, my parents took me to see my great-grandmother. Now, my great-grandmother was, she had diabetes back in the old days, so she'd lost an arm, a leg, and an eye, and so they take me to see her. I am convinced that there's one of those fairy tale things going on, and I am going to be given to, the poem is called Witch. We drove into the country, way down a red dirt track, then stumbled up a path and bushwhacked to a shack. She only had one arm. She only had one leg. She only had one eye, a bright red Easter egg. "Come here and hug your granny," the old witch squawked at me. "Go on," my mother whispered, and shoved me with her knee. Did she have an understanding to give me to the witch? I had heard of Rumpelstiltskin. My face began to twitch. "Come to your loving granny," the old witch shrilly said. Again, my mother shoved me, and this time smacked my head. I inched away from Mom and Dad. I swore I'd always hate 'em. The witch smelled of used grease, mildew, and mentholatum. I'm sorry. I'm very proud of that rhyme. I struggled hard. I fought her. I couldn't break her grip. Who'd think it'd be so easy to make a wheelchair tip? That didn't actually happen, the last part. I should warn you, I'm reading the clean ones, by the way. Where did I put the squirrel poem? I was going to read you there it is. This is, Barry Moser illustrated this. Well, I'll read the poem, then I'll show you the photo, the illustration. You know, when you're a kid, you're always told that the squirrels are the little acrobats of the trees, the circus in the trees. I love to watch the gray squirrels leap from limb to leafy limb, tumbling like furry acrobats, and every tree their gym. The oak limbs are their trampoline, and their trapeze the pines. They stroll like tightrope walkers up the looping power lines. And sometimes they gnaw through a line, exploding as it arcs, and lighting up the evening sky, cascading down as sparks. This is Barry's illustration of the exploding squirrels. Now, if you're a gardener, you think, of course, you would love to do this to the squirrels. So I'm very lucky to have Barry illustrate it. The boy who is told, "Shut up, you're fine," is this kid. And I shouldn't even tell you this because the book had been out for about a month, and I have this poem called Satan. And somebody said to me, "That picture that Barry did of Satan, is that Dick Cheney?" And I had to look at it. And of course, that's what Barry had done. He made Satan Dick Cheney. I'm gonna end reading from this book with a poem called Jim the Car. It's a kind of an odd thing. There was a kid that I went to high school with who, I don't know that he thought he was a car, but he acted like a car. So he would go through school like this. Everywhere he went. I think his actual name was Scott. I'm not sure. But then I thought of Tony Early's book, Jim the Boy. And I know Tony a little bit, so I figured it would irritate him if I call my character Jim the Car. Jim the Car. He sputters his lips with a guttural rumble, a V8 blast plus a timing belt stumble. He downshifts to third and floors the gas, slews sideways, corrects it, and pulls out to pass. Two drag-assing fat girls blocking the hall like side-by-side big rigs slowed to a crawl. They ought to print wide load on their asses. They're holding up traffic. I'm late for my classes. He bleats like an air horn and flips them the bird as they blink their eyes. Not sure what's occurred. He squeals, laying rubber. His racing slicks spin. That weirdo belongs in the state loony bin. The second girl says, "I guess it's carthotic." The first girl replies, "It's autoerotic." He zooms down the hallway, bends into curves, and revving his engine, he upshifts and swerves toward algebra class. Not hearing their jeers, roaring louder and louder, he winds through the gears. They're gone, they're behind him, their history, they're lost. He's a 440 Hemi with a glass pack exhaust. Thank you. Now, Aaron didn't tell you that we're offering a special tonight, which is I brought in one of my other books, and for every one of these books of mine you buy, you get a free book. And same with her. She's got a book of hers. Now, if you don't want her second book, you can still get one. Because I got plenty of them. All right? I have a new book coming out next March. I just got the page proofs. I haven't even proofed them yet. Let's hope all the words are here. It's called American Rendering, and it's my new and selected poems. So it picks up from every one of the books that I've done, every one of the poetry books that I've done since 1985, my first. And I thought I'd just read you a few of those, if that's all right, even though, alas, it is not for sale until March, but you can mark your calendar. First poem, simply called, this is the first poem in the book, it's called My Daughter. I don't have a daughter, but I've thought about it. You get a little older, you think, I wouldn't mind having one. I mean, not a young one, but somebody like, well, okay, take care of me. Not one I had to take care of.
Not one either.
Yeah. My daughter. After midnight, I dragged carpet padding from a trash bin and spread it on the asphalt between the wall and dumpster. Screened from sleet, I pulled carpet remnants over me. And that night, I married, raised a family, and outlived everyone except a daughter, a teacher, and her two children, one damaged. I woke when a bread truck scraped the bin. From under damp carpet, I watched punctilious men sign invoices, sweep, hose down the docks. A boy in a bloody butcher's smock leaned against the wall and smoked through bloody fingers. At night, I search and sometimes find my daughter. I make good money now, I tell her. Let me take Teresa home with me. I can buy the help she needs. My daughter smiles, asks how I'm doing. And I lose the moment to my wife, my job, my actual family, as the thick-faced infant bucks in her arms or beats her forehead hard and almost musically against the table. When I clench her to my belly, she screams, red-faced and rigid, "Hush, hush, hush," I serenade her. Oh, unhushable baby, hush. When I was in graduate school, I found a shortcut the house that I was in was about 10 feet from the Rock Island line. This is not a good place to be when the cars come through, but for a long time they didn't, so I assumed that this was an abandoned track, and so going into school, I'd get on the track, walk down it, walk across the trestle across the river, and one day a police officer stopped me and said, what they always say, don't do that, and I explained to her that the trains didn't use it, and she ordered me down anyway. And the next day, I was walking underneath it, and I saw a train go across the trestle. And you can just imagine, you're imagining yourself standing in the middle of the trestle over the river and having to jump. The poem is called Walking a True Line. Red lights whirling behind me in the sun. A cop ordered me off the trestle. "Why?" I asked, squinting. I knew what she'd say. I loved this shortcut to my bad job. Loved walking above the street and then above the river, mincing across the slick, splintering ties, a true line against a hard blue sky, teasing a fear of heights with a love of rivers. "The trains don't use it anymore," I called down to the voice that yelled what authority must yell. "Get down anyway." What a surety the state was. Mom with a holstered 9mm. That evening, as I trudged obescent below the trestle, giving Mom time to forget, the creosoted posts oozing tar shuddered like oracles. Above, unseen, a lugubrious chugging mass passed over, painstakingly almost half aware, as gods proceed when they think they love us, we who are in this world to be swept away. And a poem about those odd moments after a memorial service where you've gone outside. And, you know, as you all know, at a certain point in your life, you suddenly start going to these things, and then they increase in frequency. Outside the inn. On the way out, I gripped his arm, squeezed, let go. He was talking to another black suit. We were all black suits for the funeral. And his bicep shifted in my grip, lax. Had he been ill? We smiled, nodded. That was all, and for old friends, sufficient. Outside the inn, peonies, those great nodding heads, unstable bobbers, climbed the wall and spilt onto the roof, storming the inn. "I didn't know peonies could do that," I said, and my wife, marveling with me, red, pink, and white petals stippling the bricks on which we stood, replied, "They can't." We parted the dark, dull leaves and considered in the shadows a hidden trellis hung with green pots on green hooks and hundreds of neatly twisted green wires. The inn opened behind us, murmuring, "We must soon, yes, must," and reluctant to be seen, seeing, we stepped away from the green wall, the impossible possible once more, and beauty in perspective, beautiful. All afternoon and into evening, I considered my house, car, wife, mirror, close, then distant, distant, then close. All afternoon and into evening, I placed myself before them, grieving. Another thing we do, of course, is go to weddings. And a couple of weeks ago, we were at my niece's wedding. I was fairly long in the pool. I said 7 years and 2 children. The women were tough. One of my brother's wives has 3 years, no children. And one was 2. Right? One was, they're tough. They were tough. It's an epithalamium, simply, you know, a marriage poem. But I was sitting there thinking, this is kind of the marriage poem when you're sitting there in church and you're going, I don't think so.
I don't know what the hell they think they're doing, but this one's a mistake. And this is other thing too. I had vaguely a former student in mind when I was writing this, and so far it's been a great marriage. They got a couple of kids. They've been going on 15 years now, utterly and completely wrong. But that's the good news. Epithalamium. Friends, we stood in church for you as you knelt before the priest, your faces glowing. Ours glowed too. And our love for you increased as we glanced at one another and thought, it isn't going to last. He's strayed before, and she'll take comfort as it's offered. She has in the past. That's how you met. Did you wed in haste? Or did you court too long and settle into all but marriage? Not right somehow, not wrong. Careful, we thought approvingly, and then too careful. But now you're married, and we pray you won't respect your wedding vows for fear, the kids, or obligation to prayers you would unpray, as we have done, but from a choice you choose again each day, with joy, each breath, an affirmation, as we have also done, a few of us, after rage, raw sorrow, change, and slow reunion. I think it's only fair to give you, in poetry readings, I think there's a state law that we have to give you a three-poem warning. That 3 poems to the end so you can go into your hurry-up offense. Like a lot of us, I guess, I was very, I was in high school, I guess, during Freedom Summer when Andrew Goodman, James Chaney, and Michael Schwerner were murdered in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And through investigative reporting, we now know who did that, pretty much. I mean, we know, but not quite provable. And we know what happened. And this is a poem about that. The names of the lost. The nights burned all night long that freedom summer. 94 at midnight, 80 at dawn. Late June, a high-speed chase. Goodman, Chaney, Schwerner rammed off the road and hustled from their car. Wayne Roberts asked, "Are you that nigger lover?" The nights burned all night long that freedom summer. "I know exactly how you're feeling, sir," said Schwerner. Roberts shot him in the heart. They shot them all, Goodman, Chaney, Schwerner. "You didn't leave me nothing but a nigger," Jim Jordan griped, "but at least I killed me one." The nights burned all night long that freedom summer. Ray Killen prayed a funeral prayer. The preacher beseeched God's mercy on these communists, these agitators, Goodman, Chaney, Schwerner, before they buried them using a bulldozer. The murderers, old men now, still walk the town. The nights burned all night long that freedom summer. Ask Andrew Goodman, James Chaney, Michael Schwerner. A poem about my mother. You'll recognize, I think, what happens here. You know, it picks up from that scene in the Aeneid where Aeneas goes to see his father. I almost said Virgil goes to see his father. Aeneas goes to see his father, and he has to make a blood offering to get the spirit's attention.
came back. When I came back, can I say it that way? I read it wrong. Came back. When my mother came back, can I say it that way? Came back. She flitted witlessly, kitchen, living room, never settling, like a child or a fly. Mom, I called. Mom. Her eyes flashed by me without lighting, but she hesitated, and with a kitchen knife, I slashed my thumb. Blood, and she ran to me. Blood, and she called my name. What do you want? Say it, I ordered, holding my hand behind my back like a gift for a child, for an adult, a bribe. She wanted blood. Blood and her slippers. Funny, I'd have guessed blood, cigarettes, and a story to make her laugh. She drank at my white hand till I grew faint. Then she drifted off. For that minute, that moment, that passage of time, I was not childless. Or a man. I'm going to end with the last poem in this section of the new book, the last of the new poems, in the new and selected. It's called Lightning Strike in Paradise. And in the poem kind of gets into, I guess, that sense of a moment that is kind of a moment, when you experience a moment that's outside of time, that seems holy, even if there's intrusions on it. Lightning strike in paradise. Jesus the wind combs Jesus the rye and shakes the limbs of Jesus the scrub pine and alder, while a tractor, disking the rye, churns into the sunset, red clouds of Jesus. Jesus, the bank of young ferns, fringes Jesus, the sluggish and rocky stream, rich with tadpoles, crayfish, and almost invisible minnows, all Jesus himself. Jesus, the green worm, inches up air. He humps his body, pulls his end to his middle, and pushes upward to where he started, climbing his own fine thread, until a gust of Jesus snaps the silk and sends him flying. Jesus, the lightning, explodes an oak. Jesus, the thunder, reverberates through green leaves, the Jesus leaves, silencing the Jesus chitter of squirrels, wrens, and cicadas. And in the distance, the tractor never stops grinding rye into the earth, preparing it for seed, as the unfixed scent of sundered oxygen settles over heaven. Thank you.